This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. The Pew Research Center says about 70% of Americans, 70%, use social media. Live tweeting our favorite TV shows, sharing meals on Instagram, sharing thoughts on Facebook. Social media has not just changed the way we live, but definitely changed the way we shop. Many brands use influencers, people with large online followings, to help them sell products and services. How is this shaping advertising and sales? And do we even know we're being advertised to? Joining us to discuss it for the rest of the hour is Britt Abutaleb. She's the editor-in-chief of RACT, and she joins us from NPR in New York. Britt, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Winter Mitchell, a content and influencer strategist at Pablo Jobs. Winter, welcome.
Welcome, and thanks for having me.
And here with me in the studio is Danielle Kurtzleben, political reporter for NPR. Danielle, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about social media influencers, especially if you yourself have been influenced by someone on social media to use a particular product or service, maybe if their influence backfired and pushed you away from using a product, or if you just have questions about the way all of this works. Email 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Britt Abutaleb, let me start with you. At what point do we refer to someone who is just popular online as an influencer? Is there a certain threshold that has to be crossed? Is it the number of followers you have? What makes somebody an influencer per se?
Well, I think as soon as somebody influences you to make a purchase or spend even a dollar, then that person qualifies as an influencer. The larger your following, the more influential you are. But there are some influencers who really court a very niche following and maybe only have 100,000 or 200,000 followers on Instagram. But their followers are very loyal and very influenced by their suggestions. And so they will buy sort of anything they suggest. You don't necessarily have to have Kylie Jenner level followers to be an influencer.
Now, when you say 100,000 followers as niche, I think for a lot of people, that sounds like a lot of people to be following you.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think, there are different levels of it. I think sometimes you have sort of if you want to talk about the coolest person in a friend group, and maybe that person is the person who can influence you to buy this t-shirt instead of that t-shirt or use this moisturizer instead of that one. I think that when you're looking at brands and who they're choosing to partner with in social media language, which is sort of a thinly veiled term for advertise with, they are going to look to see the scope of their influence and to see, I think as soon as you sort of hit even the 10,000 follower mark, if you're looking at something like Tetox Diets, which is a really popular sort of partnership that influencers all over the spectrum have experimented with, 10,000 is sort of a threshold at which you can start to say, oh, this person is reaching more than just their particular circle. So maybe there's an opportunity for us to partner with them more in a cheaper way than if somebody has 100,000 followers.
Winter Mitchell, what makes for a great influencer other than the amount of people who follow them? What kind of content are we talking about that gets people to be influenced?
I think I can give you a really good example that's pretty recent. Katy Perry obviously has this Witness album that she's pushing, and she just spent about 3 or 4 days on YouTube live streaming, and that's pretty unprecedented. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that from a star of her magnitude, and just sort of being willing to go out there and push herself out there and invite all these famous friends and all these other influencers. That's the type of content that we are going to start seeing a lot more of going forward. I think when you think about like Instagram, when you think about Facebook and Twitter, each platform sort of does its own thing and it has its own sort of programming strategy depending on the influencer. So for me, good content tells a story. I just want to know where this is going, or it can be completely random. But when you have someone that's like a celebrity or someone who is an actual social influencer that you can follow, so I hate to use the proverbial standards that we're talking about, the Kardashians, you kind of want to know where things are going.
Right.
There's always sort of like a plan behind it. But the thing that I loved about Katy Perry's live stream, there really didn't seem like there was a plan behind it. It seemed like she just wanted to meet a bunch of people, get more woke, make bear her grievances and sort of bear her heart, mm-hmm. but she was still pushing a product. Everything surrounding the live stream was just in support of this album.
Lest we think that this is just purely frivolous, I think the most well-known social media influencer in a way around the world right now, I would argue, is Donald Trump. That's kind of how he made a lot of his bones as a politician and began to win over a number of people who became his supporters at the polls. Danielle Kurtzleben, you headed up part of a project where NPR reporters were annotating the president's tweets. When we're talking about political influence, what did we learn works?
Right. So just to sort of hinge off of what I believe it was Britt was saying, it was, you know, you become an influencer when someone spends money on a product. Of course, Donald Trump is not, at least on Twitter when he's campaigning, he's not hawking a product that he wants money for. What he's hawking is himself. So instead of spending money on him, maybe something analogous you could say is that he wants people to spend their time, their attention on him, and of course, to get votes. But of course, you know, he's tweeting even now. So I would say that, you know, that's sort of what is driving him. And, you know, it's really interesting. I would say that in the election, his tweets were very polarizing. I mean, they may have driven votes on the margins, but I would argue that most Americans sort of knew what party they wanted to fall behind. But listen, you know, Americans always say they want their politicians to be authentic. Donald Trump is aggressively unfiltered on Twitter. And to Americans who like that, that probably made them more enthusiastic about it. To people who did not like that, that probably made them wag their finger at him, which also creates a sort of cycle that, you know, the more people got angry about some of Donald Trump's tweets, the more a certain segment of his supporters would rally behind him.
We are talking about social media influencers with NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, Winter Mitchell of Pablo Jobs, Britt Abutaleb of RACT, and with you. Share your questions and thoughts about influencers on social media, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Bourgeois Baby tweeted us, "I'm a small business owner that finds social media influencers helpful, but I can't afford the money they now charge. Big business has infiltrated social media influencers, which has hurt small businesses." Britt Abutaleb, how much money are we talking about?
Oh, well, you know, sometimes it's just people will wield their influential power just from free products, but they can go all the way up to, we're talking $250,000 if you are an A-list, you know, celebrity influencer.
$250,000 for doing what exactly?
For posting an Instagram, you know, an Instagram that you can take down in a few days.
So if I'm popular enough, some brand will pay me $250,000 to make one Instagram post and then take it down?
Potentially, yes. We did a story, an investigation into detox diets, which I mentioned earlier, last year on RACT. And for that particular product, and there are, you know, hundreds at this point of detox companies that advertise via Instagram, and they range, pay anywhere from $3,000 to $250,000. It can be very expensive. A lot of major luxury brands at this point aren't even casting people in their campaigns or spending advertising dollars unless they can use influencers sort of at every step of the way, from the hairstylist to the makeup artist to the model to the stylist, to make sure that they are sort of getting the full influencer effect. And that can be very expensive, you know, but arguably less expensive than a full page ad in Vogue magazine, for example, and easier to track.
Yeah, I imagine so. And Danielle, it seems like this was part of the wisdom of the Trump campaign's economic strategy, that it cost them a lot less to reach their base than they would have spent on TV or radio.
That's fair. Yeah. You know, I mean, Donald Trump spent far less on advertising in the primaries than his Republican rivals. You'll remember Jeb Bush, for example, threw money at advertising. He amassed, through his super PAC especially, lots and lots, many millions of dollars. And you make a great point here. It was very efficient for him, especially because, you know, listen, Donald Trump, because he's so authentic, like I said, makes news on Twitter. We in the news media decide what to follow, and we sometimes covered his tweets.
Danielle Kurtzleben of NPR, Winter Mitchell of Pablo Jobs, and Britt Abutaleb of RACT, as we continue our conversation about social media influencers and the way they do what they do. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. It seems there's always a risk, though, of maybe going too far, because typically, you know, we don't always hold advertising in very high regard. We heard a number of comments from listeners who are not big fans of this, including one who left a message in our inbox.
Hi, this is Isabel calling from Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. I'm calling in regards to the prompt about social media influencers and if I've ever bought anything. And the answer is no, because it drives me insane. People use social media nowadays to make money, basically. They're just advertising for stuff that they're selling, and it drives me, and I know my other friends, nuts. So I know that it's great for some people, but I just think it is way over the top nowadays.
Yeah, Isabel, thank you for calling in. And what Isabel suggested is also being echoed by some of our other listeners. One wrote on our website, the1a.org, in general, the whole practice of marketing puts me off. I see it simply as an attempt at manipulation. Winter Mitchell, what do you tell clients in terms of the way they use social media to influence so they don't come across as being crass?
I think I really want my clients in particular to be authentically who they are. I think that's what their followers expect. I also do like to apply a little bit of restraint, because I want them to be able to draw in an audience that they may not have otherwise had access to. And those things happen just by appearing in movies or doing a TV appearance or whatever that may be, anything. They might appear on someone else's social platform, but I want them to be able to be authentically themselves. I think that people, because of Trump, people are much more aware of authenticity, and they are able to catch when something does not feel true to their brand, or it feels like somebody's trying super hard to do something else. I think that I really want to, whomever I work with, I really want them to know what their goals are, and I want to help tell that story in the most authentic way possible. And sometimes that just makes content super revealing, and sometimes it might make it a really vulnerable. But I think we've come to expect that as a content channel.
Now, Britt, I have to question this idea of authenticity. I don't think there is anything authentic. And call me cynical, I don't think there's anything authentic on Kendall Jenner's Instagram feed. I don't think there's anything authentic on any of the Kardashians' Twitter feeds, because they know they're being watched. They're models, they're reality stars, they're marketing an image. Even me, like the me that you hear on the radio, is as clear a version of me as I can be, but I'm not going to tell you everything. I'm not going to tell you about my biases or my political beliefs. Like, this is a manufactured image on purpose. It seems like the whole authenticity thing is also part of the marketing. Like, you're never really seeing the whole picture, especially on somebody's social media feed, are you?
No, but I don't think you need to see the whole picture to be authentic. We were actually having a conversation in the Racked HQ earlier about Kylie Jenner, who is this year on the Forbes list, one of the highest paid celebrities. And yes, she's getting money from a lot of different directions, but her big sort of thing right now is her makeup collection. And that is something that feels authentic to the Kylie Jenner brand in a way that she really owns it separately from the rest of her family. And the success that she found by latching onto something that seemed true to her, at least true to the image she projects, I think is an interesting look at authenticity in a way that maybe doesn't, you're not getting the whole picture, but I don't know that you necessarily need the whole picture to find a thing that does feel true to her.
Britt, what demographics tend to be targeted by social media influencers? A lot of what I hear about has to do with clothing and fashion and makeup. Is it mostly young women that social media influencers are targeting, or are there targets on everybody?
I think there are targets on everybody. The fashion and beauty space is a majority of sort of the influencer space when we talk about it, especially on Instagram. But I think I don't think anyone's immune to this. And like I said, like the Jenners and the Kardashians represent sort of the highest level of influencer, but there are, other levels that are smaller and that do feel more authentic. From travel bloggers who have channeled their adventures onto Instagram and really do inspire people to go to a new place or seek out a new adventure. There's one influencer, blogger, photographer named Jamie Beck, who has been living in Provence for the past year. And I've found myself influenced by her, even though I sort of know the ins and outs of influencers and consider myself immune to their influence in many ways. And that's because she's genuinely discovering this new, having this new experience and inviting her audience along for the ride. And as she is genuinely excited by it, so am I. And so I think there's you can sort of be influenced without even realizing that you're being influenced. And that unless you're completely disconnected from everything, it's hard to really cut yourself off from that.
Danielle Kurtzleben, who else do you see as it relates to political influencers who seems to be particularly adept? Donald Trump obviously gets all the attention because he was such an unconventional candidate and now president. But who else is kind of running things online well?
Right. So the people who tend to get the attention are people who, once again, seem to be authentic, who say they are and seem to be writing their own tweets. So Claire McCaskill, for example, Democratic senator from Missouri, she says she writes her own tweets. And, you know, during the current time when Republican senators are writing their health care bill, you have seen her in the last day or two really shooting back at them. She is willing to be quite pugilistic on Twitter about things. On the Republican side, I would be remiss if I did not mention Republican Senator Charles Grassley from the great state of Iowa, where I'm from. Charles Grassley has a very odd Twitter feed, is maybe the best way to put it. It is often, you know, a pretty dull feed of, I hung out with this Iowan, here's a photo of us. But sometimes he throws in some real curveballs. Maybe his most famous tweet was one from 2014 where he wrote, Windsor Heights Dairy Queen is a good place for you know what. And everybody went, No, I don't know what, actually. Honestly,
Senator.
I'm not quite sure. Yeah. I
may not want to know what.
Well, yeah. I mean, I believe he addressed it later and said, you know, it's, I don't remember what it was. It might have been, he just said, it's a good place for ice cream.
But. I have to also say that I think a few lawmakers are becoming online sensations through memes, like Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California, who has just been reading people up and down with her eyes lately. Or even
right.
Kamala Harris from yesterday's hearing at the Senate Intelligence Committee had a few very meme-worthy moments.
Her
that
facial
just became...
expressions took over Twitter for a short while.
Yes.
Yeah.
So getting other people to kind of lionize you also raises your status.
Right. Well, and in that respect, Elizabeth Warren does a great job because people take clips of her speeches and they will put them out there and say, you have to watch this. You have to hear this.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation about social media influencers in a moment, including what the rules are. There are rules, federal rules, on advertising on radio and TV. What about social media? Does the federal government govern that? We'll continue our conversation about the federal rules around social media influencing and about a social media influencing situation that went very, very wrong. Fire Festival, anyone? Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about conspiracy theories. NBC News is under fire for an interview that has not aired yet, a conversation between its newest star, Megyn Kelly, and Alex Jones, the creator of the conspiracy theory website InfoWars. President Trump has appeared on InfoWars several times. Advertisers are pulling out of the NBC broadcast since Jones has called 9/11 an inside job and suggested that the Sandy Hook shooting was a hoax. How has a conspiracy theory affected you personally? Have you fallen for one, acted on it, and regretted it? Or perhaps you had to deal with someone who acted on a hoax or who just refused to believe it was not true. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. How has a conspiracy theory affected you personally? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and press option 2. You can also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We'll consider what to do about conspiracy theories and share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation about social media influencers with NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, Winter Mitchell of Pablo Jobs, and Britt Abutaleb of RACT. Still time to get in your questions and thoughts. Email 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's broaden the conversation a little bit to a recent social media influencer debacle. One listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, examples like Firefest are exactly why no one should take celebrity endorsements seriously. It's sad how easily people can be duped these days. Britt tweeted us, huge backfire from social media influencers, Fire Festival that turned into the Hunger Games. Well, joining us now to discuss it, also from NPR in New York, is Jake Horowitz, the co-founder and editor-at-large of Mike. Jake, welcome to 1A.
Hello, and happy to be here.
Also with us to discuss the rules, the guidelines on social media advertising, is Mary Engel, the head of advertising practices for the Federal Trade Commission. Mary, glad to have you with us.
Good to be with you as well.
Jake, first of all, let me start with you. What was Fire Festival? What was it supposed to be, and what did it turn into?
Well, Fire Festival was one of the most high-profile music festivals that we've seen in recent memory. It was scheduled to take place at the end of April in the Bahamas, in Great Exuma Island. And it was marketed by and envisioned by 25-year-old Billy McFarland, who is an entrepreneur here in New York, and his co-founder Ja Rule, who's a famous musician in his own right. The idea was to have this big festival down on in the Bahamas for 2 weekends, bring people from all over the country who paid thousands of dollars to get there, and it was marketed very, very heavily by social media influencers. The problem was when everybody got down to the Bahamas, it was not what they were advertised and promised, and it was a very well-documented and ridiculed moment on social media where, you know, folks got down there and it was quite literally a disaster scene, and things weren't set up in the way that they were advertised.
Jake, elaborate on that a little bit more. I understand that the Fire Festival was not just not what they were promised. It was kind of disgusting. Like when they got there and realized what they were going to get, it was just pretty pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, there were all kinds of well-documented examples of turmoil, whether it be, you know, bathrooms that were, you know, literally chaos on the island, or food, which wasn't there. You know, at Mike, we actually came upon thousands of emails and documents detailing internal conversations which took place amongst the team in the lead up to the festival. You know, the way that Billy McFarland and Ja Rule explained the chaos that that paying customers got when they were on the island was that, oh, well, it was just sort of a, you know, we got in over our heads at the last minute and there was a rainstorm on the island the night before and there was things that we couldn't control. What we learned at Mike through our investigation was actually a number of these issues were bubbled up by the team for weeks and weeks and weeks in advance. And there were lots of signs that whether it be on housing or whether it be on bathrooms or food or a lot of these issues, there was, you know, signs from the team that there was going to be chaos ahead.
How many people were going to Fire Festival? Were we talking about just a few hundred super well-connected people or like thousands and thousands?
There were going to be about 2,500 people, somewhere in that range. That's the estimates. Some folks paid reportedly upwards of $12,000 or more for their tickets. It was going to be a multi-weekend affair where folks, you know, were going to be on the island. They were going to be in the Bahamas. They had been promised high-profile villas where they could, you know, really enjoy themselves. And of course, as mentioned, some of these folks who paid, you know, these thousands of dollars got to the island and saw a very different experience, which is why McFarland and Ja Rule now currently face upwards of about a dozen lawsuits, some by the ticket holders, some by vendors, alleging that they were deliberately misled in the advertising of this festival.
Mary Engel, before I come to you with more about the overall rules for social media advertising, and I understand, and I'm not, the Fire Festival is an ongoing investigation, so I won't ask you about that. But before we talk more about the federal rules, I wonder, Winter Mitchell, if maybe this is just a case of fools and their money being soon parted. I mean, if these are people who have the means and the money to go to the Bahamas for weekends, not just a weekend, to see all these artists and put down thousands and thousands of dollars for an event that literally does not exist, maybe this is an outlier. Is Fire Festival really one of those warning cases that people should pay attention to? Or was this just people with too much money and not enough sense?
I think it's a combination of both, to be honest. You know, they're big music festivals that are real, that are actually happening. Their marketing is primarily focused on getting people there locally, getting people to nationwide, worldwide to know about it. So they use all types of marketing channels to get that out there. I have to be honest, I didn't hear about this festival anywhere else but Instagram. So they knew who they were targeting and they knew who they were going after. I think it's an outlier in the sense that now it's exposed how much fraudulent behavior occurs on the platform, how you're constantly being misled into, you know, clicking something, buying something, getting something. And I think this opened a can of worms for people to understand that not seeing isn't always believing. I mean, anybody with the wherewithal to do a little bit of research could have seen that this is not a real thing. It's not actually real. And the fact that they spent so much of the money that was purportedly earmarked to produce the actual event and spent most of that on paying the influencers upwards of, I think, like $200,000 just for a post, shows that their focus was trying to part fools with their money. And that's pretty, that's really nefarious. Like, that's really scary.
Mary Engel, let me come to you in terms of what the guidelines are for social media influencing. If I am a celebrity and I am paid to help hawk a product on my Instagram feed, for example, can I just post that and say, hey, I love such and such a product. You should try it too. What do I have to do with that post to make it legit under the federal government's rules?
So under Federal Trade Commission guidelines, what we say is that marketing or advertising should always be identifiable to consumers as marketing, no matter the media that it appears in. And the issue with celebrities posting on Instagram is you can't always tell whether they're doing that because they are being paid or have a relationship with a marketer, or they're just doing it on their own, which is really in contrast to, say, a traditional TV ad where you see a commercial, you see a celebrity on a commercial, you just assume that they're being paid. That doesn't need a separate disclosure. But outside the context of conventional advertising, consumers don't have those cues. So what we say is that there needs to be a good, clear, and conspicuous disclosure that they're being paid or that they have this sponsorship relationship with the brand. And we don't dictate the exact terminology that should be used, but we should say it should be language that's understandable to consumers, like ad or sponsored, and it should be placed in the post where consumers are going to see it and not kind of hidden someplace.
Well, clearly there are a number of people online who are not only noticing some of these ads, these paid posts, but they're also apparently benefiting from them. They say that they're kind of a good thing. Here's one listener who left a message in our inbox.
Hi, I'm Paula from Pennsylvania. I made a purchase through Influence on Instagram. I follow a lot of barbecuers and smokers, and they had promoted this spray on wing sauce, which sounds absolutely strange, but it's one of the most amazing products I've ever found. So I've had a very, very good experience following people on Instagram and following their suggestions. I feel like these people definitely do a lot of what they do, and they've got a great idea of how to do it. So I'm going to keep following their suggestions because so far, so good.
Well, Paula, thanks for calling in and telling us about your experiences. So, Mary Engel, you said there are no strict federal rules on what form that has to take. Are we talking about someone putting hashtag ad in the post? Like, would that do it?
Yeah, we've expressed our opinion. Hashtag ad would be good enough as long as it's placed where consumers can see it. And the problem that we've seen is sometimes it's placed at the end of the post, and especially a long post where consumers won't see it. Because on Instagram, if the post is longer than three lines, the rest gets kind of tucked under and you have to click more to see it. So if it's at the end, you're not going to see it there. Or we'll see a clutter of hashtags or handles. There'll be a whole bunch of them together and hashtag ad will be placed among them. And so that won't stand out either. So, you know, it can't just be kind of paying lip service to including the disclosure. It's got to really be placed where consumers will see it.
Mary, I remember reading an analysis from BuzzFeed that went through some posts from top celebrities on Instagram and found that 93% of them were not properly labeled as ads or being sponsored. Is this keeping the FTC busy with enforcement? How much energy are you putting into making sure that influencers are playing by the regulations?
Well, we do pay a lot of attention to the issue and are focused mostly at this point on education and making sure people understand their obligations and answering questions. The kinds of questions you're asking today, we do get from both influencers and firms and brands working with influencers, and we want to make sure people understand the rules of the road. And we bring targeted law enforcement actions cases when appropriate as well, where we seek pretty egregious violations. But, you know, the thing about it is there, it's always important to focus on, I think, education first, because our goal here is really compliance. We don't want to play gotcha. We want to make sure everybody understands the rules of the road.
And what are some of the penalties if someone does break these rules?
Well, we can have them be subject to an order, basically, and like a court order that prohibits them from engaging in the same conduct in the future, and have monitoring or compliance obligations, so to make sure that they don't do this again. There are no fines attached to violating the FTC Act. We get that question a lot. There may be, they're going to be fined. We don't actually have fines for violating the FTC Act, but living under an order is not a lot of fun either.
Well, let's see if we can get in a few more quick questions before the hour is up. Colin emailed, "I'm a furniture designer with 17,000 followers. Every week I get messages offering to influence for me and asking me to influence for other people. I've tried both exactly once, but it all feels like a pyramid scheme. Is it?" Winter, what do you think? Is this just a pyramid scheme?
It's not necessarily a pyramid scheme, but I don't recommend it. Each platform knows when you are trying to mess with their system, and they will find ways to penalize you for it. For instance, on Instagram, if you try to use like InstaFollow or InstaBoss, yes, you will see an immediate boost to your following. You'll see a little bit more engagement, but it will start being so erratic that Instagram will flag that account because they have the means and ways to do so. And then they'll either take your verification mark away or they'll shut down your account completely. I don't recommend it. I really, really believe with all my clients in building true engagement so you get that good reach.
Yeah, that verification mark, that little check mark in a blue circle. Jake, I wonder if you could take this question from a listener briefly. They write, "I used to work for a shopper marketer which specialized in social influence. The company was able to use a curated group of mom bloggers. Though I found the method to be genius, I don't think it's sustainable. If everyone is an influencer, who is the consumer?" Jake?
Well, I think that's definitely a good question. I think, in the era in which we are in, the listener does raise the rightful question of, who is an influencer in today's day and age? And, as we talked about in the beginning of the segment, I mean, how many followers do you need to have in order to be one? I think at the end of the day, it comes back to, as we've said over the course of the segment, what are you being influenced by, whether willingly or not? And you could be influenced by anybody.
Well, briefly, before we run out of time, Daniel Kurtz-Laban, with regard to the media that are involved, the specific social media, why do you think that certain politicians gravitate to Twitter, say the way that Donald Trump did, as opposed to Facebook or Instagram? More people use Facebook than Twitter, but we follow the president's tweets. Why do you think certain media attract certain types?
I mean, on Facebook, my guess here is that on Facebook, you're creating an image of yourself. It's not so much a real-time view into your thoughts and your ideas. It's more static, I think. It's more, you put status updates on Twitter. You put out, here's an article I like. Here is my thought on this. Here's my thought on this. It's a more fast-paced medium, and especially for someone like Donald Trump, who purports to let us inside his head to show us how impulsive he is. You could argue that that's deliberate. Some say he's creating distractions. Then Twitter works pretty well.
And Britt, briefly, why Instagram? Why so much focus on Instagram with many of these influencers? Briefly.
Because it's beautiful. You can present the most polished, colorful, well-executed aesthetic and version of yourself, and you have complete control over it.
So because it's vivid and visual.
Mm-hmm. And you can edit, I mean, you can edit pictures, you can make sure that your feed is being presented in a certain way, you can, you know, have a fancy border around all your pictures, you can edit your face in the picture. You know, there are apps that will help you have better skin or change the color of your hair. You can really, like, fully craft an image before presenting it to the world. It doesn't have to be, it's totally on your timeline, in your way, however you want to present yourself.
That's Britt Abutaleb, the editor-in-chief of Racked. Britt, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Winter Mitchell, a content and influencer strategist at Pablo Jobs. Winter, thank you.
Thank you.
Jake Horowitz, the co-founder and editor-at-large at Mike. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you very much.
Mary Engel, associate director of advertising practices at the Federal Trade Commission. Thank you, Ms. Engel.
Thanks so much.
And NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you, Danielle.
You bet. Thank you.
Remember to send us your stories about conspiracy theories, 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.